listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
So far, so good. Thanks.
And next to him, we've got sound effects guru extraordinaire, Scott Gershon.
Yeah. I'm reading his book right now.
I know.
This is great. I'm reading Bobby's book. This is amazing.
Scott, look at you, man. It looks like you're in a library with the book and the glasses, the whole thing.
Yeah, look at that.
And across the table, we've got the one and only Brandon Bertine.
What's up, Mike?
What's up, Brandon? We got some good stuff to talk about with you today.
We do. Some fun stuff.
And next to him, we've got the one, the only, the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast, until we can find a better nickname. Rob Arbiter. Rob.
Hello there, Mike.
How you doing, Rob?
I'm hanging in there. How you doing?
Doing good. And today our guest is Nobody.
Wow.
That's Mr. or Mrs. Nobody.
It's just us, boys. It is just us. Mainly because I didn't have time to find a guest. I'll tell you what, man. We just got done with the Memorial Day weekend, and I don't know about you guys, but I so needed the weekend. I took absolutely 3 days and just got away from work. And prior to that, I was coming off of a 13-day run with no less than, 11, 12-hour days. And it was literally killing me. So sometimes it's good, man. Sometimes you just need a break. You just need to step away from it and do absolutely nothing, career related. And I know, Bobby, you were saying that you needed a break too, because you can't remember the last time you took a break.
My brain froze on Thursday.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, and there's no way around it. I was going to take time off whether I wanted to or not.
So just for you guys out there that are, burning it on both ends, a break every now and then is worthwhile. And I'll tell you what, when I came back into work, I was ready to work. I was ready to mix and had a really good, fresh perspective. So a little rest does go a long way. And having said that, guys, I have no idea what's happening in the world of audio right now. I mean, I know there's a few things that I should have paid attention to. I mean, I've been kind of hearing buzz about Rob Papin's new virtual synth, his new drum plugin, but apparently it's supposed to be phenomenal, sound amazing. But anybody try it? I haven't tried it yet. I don't even know if it's out yet. I've just been...
No, I have no data on that. I will say every single thing he does, I love.
So. Yeah, me too. I'm a big fan, so it's going to be awesome. But okay, well, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. no, but having said that, I do know that there have been guys in the podcast that have acquired some really cool things. And one thing I wanted to talk about was... Brandon, why don't you tell us what you just acquired, because it's pretty darn interesting.
My new awesome fun toy is a new drum kit, and we all know the big names and drum kits out there, and I went looking for the best sounding one, not the one that, that everyone loves to play or you've heard of, and I found this Australian company called Sleishman or Sleshman, and the unique thing about their drums is there's no hardware attached to the shell. They basically sandwich the top head and the bottom head together with one long screw bracket thing, on each at each side of there. And basically what you get out of that is this resonating tone from the drum kit that it just allows that shell to resonate better. And the second thing you get out of that is that when you tune it, you only have to tune the top head, and it keeps the top head and the bottom head in tune together. So it's one, it makes it tuning a snap, and it just makes it sound great because you've got them. That's one thing drummers struggle with, is getting those heads in tune together. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it a snap. It sounds awesome.
Are they tuned exactly the same, or is the bottom head tuned third or fourth or something down?
I know some drummers like to tune the top and bottom head differently, but you can't really do that on this. But I mean, it sort of solves the problem that they're trying to solve by doing that. And it's got great tone. It just boom. Everything sounds awesome.
The tone. If you go online on YouTube, and you can find they have a bunch of demos. They ring forever. I mean, they have a really good sound effect.
Yep.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the kick. I mean, just the kick drum alone. I was just hitting it with mallets yesterday, and it's just big, big, beefy. you know, you could use it for trailer.
Is it more like a jazz kit or more of a rock kit?
They have a rock style kit, which
a little tighter.
A couple of the toms are a little bigger, and they do have a jazz kit, which the kick's smaller and the floor tom's a little smaller.
Do they have their own line of duct tape for when we don't want it to ring forever?
There's plenty of ways to dampen it. Okay. A drum. I mean, but the easiest way I got them, one, they sound awesome. Two, it's just it takes the pain in the ass of tuning your drums. It's just such a cinch, just to chun, chun, chun. And it keeps even tension on both sides.
And I will say, they don't ring forever.
They don't.
That's the thing. It's not like you're going to get this vicious ring. You're just going to get a really whole tone.
It's like a perfect tone in decay.
Decay. You know?
So you're not getting the plastic tub sound.
Right, yeah. No, it doesn't sound like, you know, like you're hitting oil can that's ringing forever.
And you can, but there's enough tone that you can really tune it to a note. Like there's two mounted toms. I mean, they're not mounted to the kick. They're on stands, sticking with their whole principle of not attaching anything to the shell. But I tuned one, you know, to a C and then a G and then the lower C and the lower tom, and they sounded awesome. You could tune them to a note.
Do you know anything about the bearing edges on the shells?
There is something about the bearing edges that I remember in reading the documentation. I don't remember all the details on that, but they are slightly... check out their website. But there is something unique about there. Why do you mention that?
Well, the bearing edges, how the bearing edges, which is the edges of the shell, basically, how those are cut really makes a big difference on how the tuning goes and the overtones. Mm-hmm. And what happens is if they're at 45 degrees, it's usually the best as long as it's even all the way around because it gives you the best combination of tuning, being able to tune it well, and also best overtones. But you find that like the cheaper drums kind of have rounded edges that are, you know, and they're not even. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is someone like the Drum Doctor, for instance, what they'll do is they'll get a drum shell and put it on a piece of concrete or a piece of granite where it's absolutely flat, and then show a flashlight underneath. And if you can see any edges, then you have to get them recut because it has to be exactly flat. And that's really the whole secret to tuning, mm-hmm. you know, a drum, actually having it tune well without any crazy overtones and stuff.
And now that you do explain that, that is what they were talking about when they were saying, mm-hmm. they're saying when you look at the top of the, look at the shell, you will see because it is all cut at an angle like that, that sometimes it'll look like it's, I forget exactly what they said, but exactly what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That it is tuned, it is cut, so it will enable it to resonate better and be in tune better, so. And here's a picture if you guys want to see.
Great. Now I got to post this.
We can post it.
Hey, well, you know what's amazing too is it's amazing how many people don't do some of the basic things when they record, like tune a drum kit. It's probably one of the easiest ways to make your drum set sound better.
And film awesome. Napkins.
Yeah.
And fill it with napkins?
Feminine napkins.
Oh. Or a wallet. Remember people use a wallet?
I remember when I was in the recording, when I was doing mixing, and someone said, do you guys have any feminine napkins? And I'm like, okay. And I remember he's like, no. So we got it. And then this one drummer I work with got an amazing sound. He opens up his heads, throws cotton balls in, puts it all in. Yeah. So the cotton, especially on the bottom, because he has bottom... heads. So when he hits it, basically the balls go up and then they dampen it down. And that was the whole concept of why I put cotton balls in.
Can you hear it? Or do you
No,
not?
What it does is it resonates, but it doesn't resonate too long.
Okay.
So you get that nice full tone, but the cotton balls slightly mute it down after the initial hit. Because every time you hit it, they rise and then they drop on the bottom head.
I was just writing this book with Ken Scott, like I think I told you guys a lot. Ken Scott is one of the four Beatle engineers and produced Bowie and Elton John and on and on. But we're talking about recording Ringo. And one of the things was the tea towels, which are these thin towels that they had put over all of the drum heads except the kick. And that's how Ringo got that sound.
Hmm.
But Ken said he's tried it with every drummer since, and it's never sounded as good as with Ringo for some reason. but it, you know, when you hear that particular sound, like right. You know, on his fills where it's very muffled and everything, right. That's what that is. There's a tea towel sitting on top of each.
Like
drum.
A Day right. of Life, the bum bum.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you can really hear that muffled sound, but it sounds great. You know, that's one thing. Isn't it amazing if you think about music, drums. The tuning of drums, just it sways back and forth. You got like in the 70s, you got that really overly muted, let's get rid of the bottom head, just have that almost cardboardy kind of sound. Yeah, and then, you know, in the 80s, you know, the power, like the big, giant, massive toms with the power tuning, you know. Yeah. And then, you get the natural tuning. And right now, it's you know.
Zeppelin always had that giant kick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they were known for that. When I was in college, we did a concert, and I was the stage manager, and I saw Lenny White tuning his drum kits. And that was just a treat because everything, he basically brought out a pitch pipe, did it, and tuned it. And then when you realize when he plays, because he had lots of toms, he was playing chords. And he had it where he can actually, by hitting multiple toms, you start hearing the chords and how they played against the music that he was actually playing to. Yeah, and it was pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of guys tune in fourths. Mm-hmm. And that's like, the jazz guys tend to like fourths. Mm-hmm. The rock guys tend to go, oh, that sounds good.
Right.
Totally. I totally can attest to that because I started off as a drum tech and I was not that technical. ding, 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 ding. Okay, here we go. It's like as long as the edges matched, okay, let's go, you know. Because why? Because you knew you were going to have to replace it the next night anyhow.
Yeah, yeah,
because
right,
there's a good
right.
chance that drum head you just put on will have a stick through it by the time the show's over.
I'd be afraid to have a drummer who, you know, ask for a chord chart before the session because it's going to tune his toms to the chords. Yeah. Well, I'd be impressed, but scared.
Did you ever have to do? Did you ever do a session where someone actually tuned their drums to the?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what happens live? I mean, you can't tune in between every song. Yeah, to every song.
No, you can't. But at a session, I always found it totally ridiculous. It never seemed to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in theory, it seems like it does, but it just never did.
No, the whole point is if a drum's doing a fill, you usually want it to stand out anyway. So,
yeah, right.
So
it blends in too much, right?
It blends in too much.
Yeah, I mean, I usually go for, like, the overall sound of the kit, you know? Mm-hmm. I think each kit kind of, there's a good tuning where it just sounds like it should be that way. Like your small tom should be up here, your mid tom's here, and your low tom's here. Mm. And then if you can get your 18 to sound deeper than your 16, then you're halfway there.
Hey, most people are just tuning to In the Air Tonight anyway. You know? As long as you got that drum fill sounding right, you're probably okay.
But having said that, there's something about a snare drum that just rings forever that works really well in some music where you can just have that open, like, bam, and where the snares just are barely touching it. I don't know.
Sometimes where drummers don't have multiple snares during songs. Cause sometimes they want a piccolo snare.
Yeah,
sometimes they want a deep snare.
Yeah.
And that's one of the few things drummers have. That you think they'd have multiples of.
Well, most drummers, like session drummers, they'll show up with one kit, but they'll have multiple snares. And, and lots of people use multiple snares live, too.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to swap out a snare.
Or they'll have a little piccolo snare on the other side of their hi-hat that they can do some cool stuff. I mean, a drummer the piccolo snare, that's another great sound-in snare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, drum.
They'll snap.
You get a snappy piccolo snare and a guy who knows how to play it. Because it's one thing to have one, it's another.
It's another thing to know how to play.
Yeah. That's one of my other favorite sounds.
Speaking of snares, have you guys seen these moon gel things that they put on the
drums? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Those are great. Like, the snare that came with this kit is pretty ringy. And, you know, obviously these are designed to have, you know, a lot of decay, but it's the snare, you don't really want that usually. And these moon gels tone it down really well.
Yeah, that works really well.
There's like these little gummy squares that you throw on the top of the head.
But you know, you should a good ring on a snare drum, believe it or not, there's something about if it's playing a little bit behind, so it's kind of in the pocket and you have a song that has a lot of emotion. That snare drum, it can be a kind of an emotional thing because you have this hanging, God, it just kind of goes out there. I mean, there's some hit records that I'll tell you one right now that can totally thank the snare drum for making that song push the way it does. Stay, Lisa Loeb. Mm-hmm. You guys even know that song? That when that snare drum kicks in, when that beat kicks in, it really pushes that. I mean, it's a good song, but when the whole thing starts going and whoever played drums on that has a nice little diddle that he's doing on the snare drum, it's just, that's an awesome sounding snare drum. It really makes that song. So don't neglect your snare drum out there.
It also depends how the drummer plays.
Yeah, no, it's so true.
Because I know one of the things when I was in college at Berkeley, and we used to do all these sessions, and usually the drum kit always stayed because you mic'd it, set it up, and then the drummers would come in with their own snares. And I remember, you know, you'd record people all day long, different drummers, all of a sudden one drummer would just get behind the kit and all of a sudden lay into it, and you're like, whoa.
I had that.
What's that?
I had that happen to me at Berkeley. I was recording the Saturday Night Live band, and there was a kit that one of the students brought in. And he sat down, he played it, and it was like, it's not so good. And I can't remember who the drummer was, but he sat down behind it, and he started to play, and I was like, this is amazing. And he's complaining, oh, this thing sounds like crap. Oh, this is awesome. And I'm thinking, wow. You know, it was like amazing the difference between, you know, whoever that drummer was and the student that put it together, who was actually a good player. But
well, I think it could just snap amazing. On it.
Yeah.
There's a good snap. When you can snap in, or especially laid-back snap, lead into it. Oh, it's just...
Yeah.
No, that's true. You bring up a good point, though, with the drummer, because it really is, you know, you can tell a drummer who really knows how to play his kit by the results that they get. Like, for instance, I was touring with Al Jarreau, and Steve Gadd was the drummer with Al Jarreau. And he showed up and he had this 5-piece, you know, Yamaha drum kit. And there wasn't really anything, you know, unique about the sound of it. I mean, it sounded good. I forgot the name of the drum tech. He was actually we became pretty good friends. Well, obviously not that good.
Not great.
Well, you know how it is on the road. You're brothers for 6 months and then, wait, what was that guy's name again? Anyhow. You know, he did a great job, you know, nothing rattled as you would, you know, imagine someone like Steve Gadd, but nothing really spectacular. He used, you know, coated ambassador heads and you played it and, you know, you're thinking that it's all in the drums or whatever. And then Steve gets up there, starts playing and can just make it sound just unbelievable. Just power in the snare and in the toms and stuff like that. You know?
Was he a heavy hitter or a light hitter?
He was, you know what? He wasn't, I wouldn't say he was a heavy hitter.
But he had a snap.
But he could hit. He was a dynamic drummer. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. He knew how to play with dynamics. You can see that when you see like on some of the Paul Simon stuff, you can just see him kind of, you know, going down and then he knows how to bring it up and he knows how to bring it down. And he's not, You know, when he plays, it's like any second, you know, the guy could go out and just absolutely blow your mind away. But he doesn't do that all the time. He knew how to do the beats. He kept a great groove. He was unbelievably just always in the pocket. And then he just knew when to, like, when he was having fun and he's kind of bouncing and doing his fills and stuff, it was just magical, you know. But all the great drummers are like that. You can tell when they're really into it. They play their kit. They know how to do it. Jerry Brown was it.
Actually going to bring up his name.
Yeah, Jerry Brown. Phenomenal drummer.
There could be an entire drum curriculum just based around Jerry Brown. He's unbelievable. And he can sit down at a kit that no one else can get to sound good. And it's just the thing that I learned, because we used Jerry on a thing not that long ago.
Right.
The thing about Jerry that was so amazing is he'll get all these polyrhythms going, because a lot of the stuff we were doing was mixture. It had some jazziness and it had you know, some hip hop and it had some rock. It was all over the place. But he would get these different patterns going, and he'd have something going on the toms that could be a certain, like, really light dynamic. But then he'll have something crazy going on the snare or the floor tom or something. And each drum, it's like he has a separate brain for each drum. And his coordination, his hands are so independent from each other and from the rest of his body. Yeah. It's just each drum kind of has its own job to do, and it does it. And I'm not sure that's something you can really learn. I mean, it's just an innate talent. But he's been Stanley Clarke's drummer for a long time, and he drummed with Stevie for a long time. And anybody learning dynamics and wanting to learn about drums should definitely check him out.
Yeah, he was actually...
He's incredible.
That's actually how I met Rob, was I was his drum tech. I got hired into Stevie Wonder's organization as the drum tech. So I got to work with Jerry for one little leg of a tour. And he was phenomenal. I mean, he is phenomenal.
And he's played with everybody.
Yeah.
And his resume's all over.
And I knew something was unique about him when he and I think we've said this on the podcast before, he would take the drumstick, he would hold it equal in the middle, put two fingers, you know, kind of out like a V, and he could play his hi-hat with both ends of the drumstick. So he would go ticka 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 ticka
with one hand.
With one hand, and then allow his like ticka 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 ticka. I mean, just do some amazing things, and he's handling all the hi-hat with just one hand instead of hitting it, just going back and forth. And that was like,
he was the first drummer I ever saw do that well. He's also the first drummer I ever saw chug hot sauce during every concert. He would have a bottle of whatever was the hottest hot sauce he could possibly find, and he would drink it during the show. And what did he used to call it? His fire or something? Or
his sauce. He needed his sauce. But
he played like he was on fire, and it's partially because he was.
Right.
There was a drummer I saw with the Yellow Jackets.
Ricky Lawson?
I don't remember. I don't think he was a young guy, very young guy. And he was playing with them. They were doing it at the Catalina Bar or whatever. Yeah. And the band was good, you know, kind of what you expected. But they had this young drummer, looked like he was in his 20s, and who looked like a friar. He had like this little ring of hair around him. And to watch him play was odd, because what you heard and what you saw seemed like two different things. But what you heard pretty much stopped everybody in their tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's keeping a really solid rhythm the whole time, doing these tasty flourishes in between. And it was amazing. And everybody was more like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Who's the drummer? And he was just totally going at it. And he had such an odd drumming technique.
I used to play with Bobby Caldwell. Hmm. Bobby Caldwell was the drummer for Johnny Winter and when they were like, you know, huge in the 70s. But he was also going to be Hendrix's drummer when Jimmy died. So he was pretty awesome. When I played with him in the 80s, he didn't want to play drums. He wouldn't be a lead singer, so he's in the front. But he would get angry at the drummer every now and then because he was so much better than him. And he'd sit down behind the drums, and his groove would be so wide. It was amazing. No matter what, you could not but help sound good with the guy because the groove was so big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As compared to, you know, everybody else, it was kind of small sounding. And he didn't sound loud. He sounded huge.
Yeah.
And there are so few drummers that can do that. I've, you know, done a lot of stuff with great drummers, as we all have.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was on another planet.
Just yeah, incredible. That's magic.
Yeah.
When that happened.
And Simon Phillips and all those guys.
Simon Phillips. Well, there's another example.
There's something with Toto. And he just laid down the tracks. And it was just, you know, just like. Just tasty.
Yeah.
You know, another drummer, I was looking him up online because I worked with him when I worked with Teddy Riley and did some stuff with SWV. And it was a drummer named Gerald Hayward who was probably, he played hip hop, best hip hop, grooviest drummer I've ever seen. I mean, this guy, what made him so good was his foot, just between his hand and his foot, just being able to do fours, do and diddle between his hand and his foot, and then just have an amazing just groove. And one time we were in rehearsal and Greg Fillinganes came in, who was a friend of one of the keyboard players, and Greg was playing and Gerald was playing, and they kind of got into this like a drum battle. And so Greg would play a lick, and then Gerald would play a lick on the drums, and then Greg would play another lick, and it was pretty amazing. Because I mean, Greg's like, blah, 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 and then Gerald's like, blah, blah, blah. And then Greg's like, blah, 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 blah. And then Gerald's like, blah, 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 blah. It was like, I mean, those were the golden moments. I mean, those are the moments like that keep you like, man, that's a great job.
You know? It is great. I think when you see any great set of musicians get together and noodle,
yeah,
it's. I mean. I've seen so many great musicians off, you know, when they're not on the stage, just noodle. And it's like, record that. Because that's some of the most amazing stuff I've heard.
You know what? That's a great point that you bring up, man. If you ever get a chance to go to a sound check or you have a friend or a buddy or anything, and you get to be around musicians when they're not on, when they're just being musicians, some true magic happens at, the, at that time. I mean, there's... well, with Stevie, that always happened when you'd come and you'd start jamming with the band. And they
was the best.
They would just go off, and you're like, holy shit.
There were plenty of those nights when they actually forgot to rehearse the show. You know, they'd sit and jam for like 6-8 hours. It's like, oh, we actually didn't run down the set list. Maybe we should do that too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just having too much fun.
What about, I mean, when I was with you, Rob, Steve at the hotel over the Marriott in New York, and he's sitting there talking to somebody, and he's noodling on the keyboard. And I'm like, whoa. It's like, what's that? Yeah. That's cool. Record that, you know? And he's just noodling.
Does he do sound checks?
Stevie does do sound checks, yeah. Yeah, and actually I'll talk about it a little later, but a long time ago I used to actually do his sound checks for him. I would sit in for him and do his sound checks, which was one of my favorite things in the world back then. But yeah, he does sound checks. He's very particular about how the place sounds.
But I will say, like, when I worked with him, and this is years ago now. Can you believe that, Rob? It's been years ago.
Well, I know it hasn't been months. It's definitely been years.
But he would come in for the first couple, like, for doing a long leg of a tour or something. He'd come in for the first couple shows, and then like, Rob would sit in the rest of the time, and Stevie wouldn't come out unless he wanted to rehearse something. And that was
his soundtrack. Yeah, if he had a new song or something.
Yeah, if his soundtrack was it was like a rehearsal and do that. But Rob, man, Rob's one of those guys that creates kind of that magic, man. I've heard him more than one time start jamming with the band. And you're like, whoa.
That was my favorite thing in the world.
Anyhow, getting back all the way back to drums. That was a nice little tangent, though. I appreciated that one. Thanks, Scott. But drum set, you're happy with?
Very happy with it. Sounds great. Still dialing in some of the tunings and just experimenting. You know, trying some different heads on it.
And what are you primarily going to use it for?
I'm going to use it for recording trailer music. Hmm. You know, so, you know, I can use it for a combination of, you know, doing just like the rock side of a trailer cue or doing, you know, just using toms and tuning them just to get that big, you know, trailer tom.
And you're going to do this in the office?
No.
He has his own studio.
Oh, okay. Are you going to leave it wired up all the time? Are you going to leave it mic'd up so it's easy?
I would like to, yes. Mm-hmm. And so that's my next... purchase is drum mics.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about those. Looking at a D112 for the kick.
Yep.
Anyone like anything better than that?
We've tried every single thing that everybody said was better, and they were all wrong.
Okay. I mean, the standards are the RE20 and the D12.
Well, right. There's D112. A new RE20. There's an RE320 that's supposed to be really good.
That I have not heard.
It's supposed to be tuned especially for
the kick. What about the Yamaha transducer head?
Oh, it's a nice sub-kick. Addition.
That's not the main one. Not your main thing. Yeah. It'd be a second.
You know what? Everybody I've talked to that's built their own has liked their own better.
And I did watch a YouTube video on how to build your own sub-kick recently.
And the reason why is the Yamaha seems to be an octave higher than what you can get with the with your own for some reason. It doesn't make any sense that would happen, but it does.
They base theirs off of, because people are using the NS10s?
Yeah, that's supposedly all it is. Yeah.
Supposedly, but... you know, I have people swearing to me that that's not the case, that they'd prefer their NS10 speaker that they had pulled out and, you know, kind of wired up. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
I listened to a few homemade ones on YouTube, and I don't know. A lot of them sounded pretty muddy, you know? Like, they'd play a D112 by itself, and then they'd play the sub-kick by itself, and then the two combined. And I was like, I just like that D112 better.
I think people fall in love with it and just pump it too much where, you know, it's kind of like if you have more than like 10%. It's like reverb. You put too much, it sounds awful.
Right.
But just the right amount is like, you know, the sheen on it.
Well, the good thing, too, is it gives you enough to record a great tone that you can kind of sculpt using EQ to where you need to take it. You know, if you don't got enough of it in the first place, then... you're going to be limited in your choices once you start trying to dial it into the mix, which the next thing would be get some good preamps too, because especially with drums.
It's a big difference.
Because you can overload some mic preamps and it just, the signal goes from...
APIs, buy some APIs. It's a perfect thing.
I mean, they're kind of like the de facto standard, you know? You
can't distort them. I mean, they just have... range for days.
3124s, you get 8 channels of that. You see that all over the place. Even, I mean, that's that's more drums have probably been recorded with that setup than any other setup out there, because they can take the punishment, man. You can hit it and it can just peg it and you're still going to get a usable signal.
Hard to make them sound bad, actually. They mm-hmm. sound pretty good, yeah. Always.
Speaking of that, I was just thinking, what could I use it, you know, if I want to start recording now with just, say, four mics, not, let alone a whole mic'd up kit, what preamps do I have? I've got the API A2D at home, then I've got my Sound Devices 302. Have you ever run drums or anything through that?
No, but it should be fine, right? Because yeah. they're made for that.
Yeah.
Put your drum and your kick on the A2D, right, mm-hmm. Using the APIs. Because your snare, I mean, and your kick, because mm-hmm. your snare will probably, you know, has the tendency to send you over. And then match your toms with your sound devices.
Yeah.
And I bet you'd get a pretty good...
Or overheads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice little overheads.
That's true. I was thinking about using my Sanken CSS5 stereo shotgun as either overheads or stick it right over the toms, maybe.
Possibly.
Do you think overheads would probably work better?
Overheads would be great.
Yeah.
You know, they do handle, because I've used them for gunshots and stuff.
Yeah.
It's a bright sound. You're not going to get that low, because Sanken rolls the low end off a little bit.
They do, yeah.
So, but you get that really bright attack, and they can take a lot of power. But usually it's, what, 57 KM84 on the snare, one of those, you know, maybe a combination of both. 57s or 421s on toms.
Yeah, you know what? It still usually for us comes down to D112 on kick, 57 on snare, yeah. 421 on toms. A Shure weird... I forget what the Shure was.
Oh, the V77?
No, it was for hi-hat. It was an SM8, maybe? I don't remember.
81, SM81.
81. Yeah, that's what it is, SM81.
Oh, yeah.
Which, it turns out, does not float. We'll talk about a flood I had at some point. I will. Maybe we'll put pictures on the website of what an SM81 looks like when it's full of rust.
But that is a standard that's been there.
It's a great hi-hat, Mike. And then overheads, a lot of times you can get creative with
B&K shots,
all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
You know.
We come back to 414s a lot for overheads, but we've tried everything.
87s for room mics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious how that Sanken will sound as in like the super wide mode as using it as an overhead or room mic.
Yeah.
I would experiment with your snare mic though. I mean, I would put the 57, but I've heard some really great things with some just amazingly ridiculous snare mics, you know, that you would like a Neumann and stuff like that. That you, well, not think, you just wouldn't want to be that near something that's coming down with that much velocity,
right.
You know, that you can always add as like little sweeteners, you know, especially if you want, depending on what you want too. If you want a lot of that, the snap, a lot of that high end, a lot of that, that attack, you know.
Ken Scott uses a C37 if he can find it. Or KM84.
Yeah, KM84, yeah.
One thing to keep in mind too, if you're using a bunch of different A to D's and you're mixing and matching stuff, be aware that different A to D converters can have different latencies in them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually screw up your phase. If you're miking a live kit and your overheads are on one set of A to D's and your kick and snare on another, you can actually have some phase problems. So be aware of that.
That's great though with workstations. Before in tape you were kind of SOL. And now you could sit there and just sit there and sample, nudge things around and go, ooh. Yeah.
Just be aware that you might have to.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a lot that's of people true. Don't think of that.
No, that's absolutely
that's a good
true.
Point.
But having said that, you know, it all comes down to also just mind your gain. If you don't have all, you know, for people that are out there that are just recording their own kit and stuff, just be aware of your own gain structure, you know, and just really listen and take time to listen to your snare, not just set your volume at a medium and then you go in there and you start smacking it and it just starts overloading, you know, really play it, you know, test records, take some time to set up properly and it'll just help you out on the backside.
Well, when the record light comes on, everybody plays twice as loud as they did in rehearsal.
Right.
And as long as you're recording 24-bit, you should just set all your levels a little lower than you think they need to be, even on your loudest rehearsal. Because you don't want to miss a performance because it clipped. And everybody, I don't know what it is about the red light, but everybody always plays twice as loud. It's the same thing like sound check versus a show. Sound check is supposed to be a representation of the show, at least in Stevie's. It was never. It was two-thirds of a show, and then it would be showtime, and everybody's just totally pegging everything. You know, it's the adrenaline gets going. So in the old days, in 16-bit and less recording, you really had to worry about the noise floor or an analog. But now with 24-bit, you have a lot more dynamic range to play with. You don't have to be so worried. Just set things a little bit low so you don't clip.
Great. Brandon, so are we done? Did we answer?
That sounds fantastic. speaking of preamps, what would be a good, something with several channels? You recommend the API?
Yeah.
Which one? APIs are great.
3124s. They come in banks of four. So you can like I said, the standard is two banks of four. So you got eight mics. With eight mics, you can pretty much
mic
any kit out there, unless it's stereo. Terry Bozio's. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about a few other things. But Brandon, I hope we answered.
You definitely did.
A ton of your questions. So we'll take a break and we'll see you guys in the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were basically giving Brandon a bunch of free advice.
There you go.
But Brandon's new drum's awesome, and can't wait to hear a recording.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear one, too.
There's a couple things I want to talk about on this second half of the Audio Nowcast. And one thing I wanted to talk about was I had a friend of mine who was saying, hey, you know what you guys should do? You should take all the cliches that you hear, the audio cliches, and address them each one individually. And I said, okay, that would be a little boring, but but then he kind of got me thinking that, you know, there are quite a few cliches out there that you hear that I, for one, just right now want to squash.
So you're talking music or sound?
We're talking about you'll see.
Testing, okay. 1, 2, 3.
No, I'm talking about
Dan Steely Dan, you know, playing on PA to tune your system.
There you go. Well, those are cliches, but I'm talking about the number one cliche that really irks me, which is
auto-tune.
No, fix it in the mix. People say that all the time. Well, we can fix it in the mix. You can fix it in the mix. First of all, you cannot fix it in the mix better than you could if you just got it right the first time. You know, and I wanted to, I mean, right? Am I right?
What's that girl that on the internet that you said was really bad? That's a fix in the mix, wasn't it?
Oh, Rebecca Black?
Right. Yeah. But what if she could have sang right the first time? You know, that's the thing is, like, you hear that, and if you're thinking that, you know, you can always do it better if you do it better. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you have to basically differentiate between things that you're actually creating in the mix, because there's no way to actually create them live.
Right.
But if it's just, you know, if you let a singer's performance go by, even though they could have done it better,
right,
just because you're in a hurry or lazy or whatever, and you say, well, we'll just fix it later, it's always better to get an additional take. If the next take isn't better, you can always go back to the previous one. But a lot of people give up way too soon.
Right. And that's not only for music. That's also in post-production. I can't tell you how many interviews I hear where they just like, oh, we're going to handle that in the mix. And you listen to it, and it sounds like they recorded right next to a generator that was buzzing, you know, 10 dB hotter than
the person saying
vocals.
That, you know, fix it in the mix, usually don't know what they're talking about. Yeah, you know, that's a good point. You know, they think we're magicians.
Yeah. So, I mean, if that ever comes up and, you know, variations of fix it in the mix, well, oh, we'll take care of this later, or we'll see what Mike can do in post. Any of those things, no. Just take a little bit of time, and let's just do it right there. So that's one cliche that I wanted to knock out. The other one that I wanted to kind of dispel was the, you'll never hear it. You'll always hear it. Mm-hmm. You will. Right, Rob?
Always. Always.
Right, Scott?
If you never hear it, take it out.
Right.
I can't tell you how many times a good example is in post-production where they're doing an interview and there might be a traffic or there might be an air conditioner. There might be something within, you know, either they should move or they should turn something off or whatever, you know, a low rumble, you know, you'll never hear that. They'll never hear that. They will. You'll always hear it. You will always, always hear it. Right, Bobby? You're looking at me like,
Well, I'll give you another perspective on it. there are cases where you won't hear it. And one I can think of is when you're mixing and you have the band with you. And everybody wants things to be louder, or that there's something that bothers somebody, or that they're freaking out about one thing. Chances are that 2 weeks later they'll forget about what that is when they hear it again.
Oh, always.
Yeah.
Or most of the time. I won't say always, but
yeah.
Most of the time.
Well, you, if something bothers you, you have to step away, come back the next day, see if you still hear it again.
Yeah, right.
Because you're focused on it.
Yeah.
But you know what I will say, though, even from a post standpoint, and I learned this from Sam Mendes, a director, and that is a lot of times, I mean, it's all about the performance.
Right.
And a lot of times we get hypercritical, like, oh, it's really noisy. And I was doing American Beauty, and there was this one scene where the two girls were out at the school and smoking cigarettes and all that. And in the background, I guess where they filmed it, there was a soccer championship for the schools. And it sounded like war. People are yelling and all these sounds are going on. And we're like, oh, we got to loop this. This is terrible.
Right.
So we loop it. Okay. We play it back. Sam goes, I hate it. And we go, what do you mean? It's clean. You can actually understand the words. He goes, yeah, but the performance isn't there. And we're like, huh? So he plays it back, and we're listening to the performance, the original crappy-sounding performance, but the performance was way better. So we cleaned it up as best as we could. And the thing is, I think most of the people don't care. So I think that's one of those things that it's always the thing that if you capture this great performance, but it's not perfect.
Right.
Sometimes it's all about the performance.
I'd say it's always all about the performance. There are so many like live albums that you'd go back and listen to, and you listen to the individual mics, and there's just no separation on anything, and it just sounds like mud. But you put it all together,
right. Yeah.
And it has an energy that you could never recreate studio or electronically.
Which is, you know, let's just fix this a little bit.
I did a Kool & the Gang record once upon a time. It was a live record, and the only thing that was kept was the bass and the audience.
Now that's funny.
So maybe it'll be, you'll always hear it, but so what? You know? I mean, literally, it's all about the performance, and I totally can agree.
But there's some great
you.
Tools out now, though. I mean, I've been using, just as far as clean it stuff, RX. Is outrageously...
Isotope RX. Is that better than Cedar?
Yeah, okay, it's different. I use WNS, Waves WNS,
right.
Which is kind of like Cedar,
right.
To take out some of the sustainy, noisy stuff.
Right.
But, you know, let's say, I'm going back to post, there's a gunshot, beautiful gunshots, tailing out really nice, bird tweet.
Right.
Right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
I take the bird out. I mean, literally, what it does is it allows you to do spectral editing.
Yeah.
So it's not that you're taking out that frequency at that time, and then it interpolates before and after and fixes it. Mm. And it's scary good.
Yeah, no, spectral editing is awesome. Sound Booth for an Adobe, you can do that too. Usually any editor that'll give you a spectral view, you can edit the spectral. Because I think Bias does it, although I'm not familiar with Bias enough. But yeah, that's...
The Isotope has a really slick interface, too.
Yeah, Isotope
is cool.
And it's not that expensive either, right?
No.
It's,
well, you know, there's two versions. There's the, I think it's the $400 version and the $1,200 version. And, you know, the $400 version is really powerful. They've got a couple things now in what they call the Pro version, which a little more resolution. But that $400 version is pretty, you know, will get you 95 to 98% there.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really good.
Nice. And finally, the last cliche that we're going to deal with right now. I guess we could file this under, is it the gear or the guy? How many times do you hear people say, you know, you give me anything and I can make it sound just as good as X, Y, and Z? And quite frankly, that's a bunch of hogwash. I think you got to be really smart in your gear as much as you have to be smart in how you use it. You know, I'm sorry, but if you get somebody behind a Legacy console and somebody behind a Behringer little, you know, mixer, even if the guy is the world's greatest mixer, you know, he's not going to get the sonic quality. He's not going to get the sound that you can get out of an API Legacy. So, and you hear that all the time. I see that on interviews all the time, you know, about, you know, it's not about the gear, it's about the guy. That's true to a certain extent, but...
But the guy's got to know how to use the gear.
That's the thing, and learn the gear and learn what pieces, you know, is the reason why Brandon comes in here and he asks our opinion for different mic pre's and things like that, because, you know, it's all part of the sonic makeup of how you're going to, what product you're going to do, you know. I mean, Rob knows this more than anybody else in here because he has an amazing set of tools in his studio. And I know you pick the gear because of all the different kinds of things you can do with all that gear, mm-hmm. right? I mean, when you approach a new piece of gear, like, it not only has to fit in what you're working on, but in your whole studio, right?
Yeah, and it's hilarious to me. I mean, so many people, when they come over and see my collection, the first question is, do you really need all this stuff? You know, why do you have so many of these? And why do you need so many of those? And my answer is always, well, they all sound different, you know, which is hard to be in it. It's hard to use that as the answer when they're asking why I have so many of the same keyboard, you know, because right. I do have some duplication, but then it's just because I don't want to run out of voices.
Right.
Like the Alesis Andromeda and stuff like that. You know, there's no soft synth that comes anywhere close to it. So if you want more than one synth's worth of sound, you got to get more than one synth.
Right.
But for the most part, I have just a wide variety of stuff because everything does sound slightly different. And if you take the time to really learn your gear, you'll understand what the differences are.
Right.
And, you know, I have a ton of different mic pre's from different manufacturers and different eras. And, you know, I've spent hours and hours and hours playing with each one of them. And so if somebody brings in a certain instrument or kind of voice and I want to record it, I have pretty good arsenal of experience to pull from.
Right.
Knowing, you know, well, her voice is kind of tinny, so we probably want to run her through that or, you know, things like
yeah.
that. Of course, we don't say it out loud quite like that. Oh, she sounds like crap. The Massenburg will clear her up. You yeah. know, we don't
but
say
like,
that.
But it's so true, though. I mean, you got to get to the point where, with your gear and where you can, like, all right, you want to go with a, you know, you want a really good R&B sound. So let's say you want a lot of high end. You want, like, hyper highs. Well, you know, you could go with, like an Avalon with the Sony mic. You know, there's that particular sound. And it's just, you know, nothing beats knowing your gear and the different types of gear that's out there. And even if you, you know, I read a really great article, and I forgot who the engineer that was talking about, but he used to rent gear. He used to rent gear on a weekend and just try it out just so that he knew how that gear sounded, just so he knew the characteristics, and made him look like a genius. And having said that, you know, there's a lot of gear that have made people's careers. You know, there's been mixers out there that have benefited because they know the gear, you know, and the gear has probably made them better than they really are. And the only reason why I'm saying that is I've heard raw Pro Tool sessions from certain things that are out there that diplomatic.
Wasn't Claire Mountain always known for his auto tuning with an Eventide? I mean, it was that's what I've always remembered. You know, I'll fix the singer a little bit.
George Massenburg, too, used to do
that. Yeah, in other words, there were people that they, before auto-tune,
right.
would just do it by listening with the little, and they yeah. it became a tool, became an instrument.
Oh, right. I spent hundreds of hours doing that.
Yeah.
I once missed out on a Christmas trip back to visit my family in Philadelphia because I was stuck in the studio tuning certain female artist's vocals that had to be done right away. I won't announce her name, but totally ruined Christmas.
Well, and I know a big mixer where they relied heavily on a certain bus compressor, and that pretty much, you know,
with three initials
made that guy's career, and it's just, but you know what? Good for him but for you know being what? Able to use the gear to get his to get his. To get his career up and running and making some outrageous money.
But you know what's interesting is because I started in music and now I'm in post-production. And I'm very much a hybrid person between instruments, between music, and even the video game side. And, you know, I'll hear re-recording mixers and they'll go, I'll just use, you know, whatever EQ there is and whatever compressor there is. And I'm like, yeah, but they all have different sounds. So when I'm doing stuff, whether I want an EVQ that has a little fatness to it.
Right.
Or an API or something else. There's all these, or phase linear EQ to get rid of stuff. they all have a different signature. And one of my favorite new plugins that I just kind of started getting into is McDSP's Retro Pack of compressors, which I think it's the 6350, I might be wrong. But it's basically what they do is have 8 compressors. It looks like a 500 series rack. And what's amazing, I did it for this project I just did a couple weeks ago, that I needed to overdrive something into it. And you can literally toggle through the 8 different compressors, and it gives you different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not subtle. And these are compressors, but they sounded amazing. So I become, that's one of the easiest things that when you just listen. A compressor is a compressor? Not at all.
Yeah.
They all have just different tones.
Yeah. No, and that's, it's so funny you say that because I got turned on to a great new plugin, dynamic plugin, the Slate Digital, their VGX virtual mastering processor. I was working on a trailer for Prey 2, actually, mm-hmm. working on the mix. And the sound designer used that for a lot of his sound design and stuff. And
you said the BX Digital?
No, FX. No, it's Slate Digital.
Oh,
it's the FGX virtual mastering processor. And he asked me, he said, do you have this plugin? And I said, no. And he said, you need to get this plugin. So I got the plugin. So when he gave me a session, mm-hmm. he had that. It's awesome. It's just, it.
You should put that on the website.
It's like, it's. Just think if the L2 sounded good. that's not the best way. I mean, the L2 sounds okay for what it does, but it can really kind of collapse your mix, and it can really, it can really take it to places where you don't want to go.
So we're not sponsored by Waves at this
point. No, we're not. No, I love Waves stuff. Listen, but
everything has a color and a flavor.
Everything has it. The thing about the Slate one is it just you can keep your transients. It keeps it all nice and punchy, but yet it really it pulls it. It tightens it up. You can really set it. When you start really compressing, it keeps the snap in there, and it keeps it open. So it keeps it open. And I know why this guy used it because, the mix is full of – it's a chase scene, and there's all kinds of gunshots, and there's all kinds of mayhem going on, and things are – you're running and stuff. And so he was able to get a ton of gain out of it and yet maintain control and keep everything
from Slate Digital, huh?
I'm getting money. Yeah, it's really inexpensive. It's like $300. It's an RTAS plugin. It's really cool. And
do they have it in VST?
I don't know. Yes, they do have it in VST. Obviously, I only use the RTAS version of it, but it's eye lockable, so you can put it on your like. And it's I totally recommend it. It was pretty awesome. And as soon as I get to spend a second day with it, I'll tell you more about it.
I love their drums.
Oh yeah, they're you know what I was. To say I was a little bit skeptical was, wow, I said that right this time,
yeah.
was, an understatement because it's like Slate Digital, because they're known for their for their drums and stuff. But once I tried out their plugin, I'm like, sold, it's really good. I recommend it. Anyhow, all that to say, on this whole gear guy thing, it's really both. You got to do it both. And as soon as you start hearing guys talk about, you give me any piece of any console and I could, outmix you or whatever. Just no, that's a bunch of crap. moving on. Before we end, I wanted to some things have happened recently and just kind of got me thinking about the bigger picture of what we do and about the bigger picture of the career choices that we've all made. And one thing I wanted to talk about was I wanted to ask you guys if you can reflect on some of the big influences in your life and your career to help you achieve what you've achieved and to take you to where you've gone. Because I think it's really important for people to, especially if you're starting out, to develop their own kind of network of support and their own kind of network of people that are kind of into the same thing that they are. Because really, there's nothing quite like developing your own network to help you get gigs, to help you get jobs, but just to kind of push you forward. And a few things happened, recently that kind of got me thinking about some of the big influences in my life and my career. And I just wanted to, start off by saying that, you know, it's amazing who influences you. And for instance, here, like around the on the podcast, you know, there's a couple guys on the podcast themselves that have been really big, instrumental in my own career. One of them is Martin. Martin Page, who hasn't been with us for a little while, but Martin was probably really responsible for, number one, working for an artist that became more than just, you know, a job. You know, we became really good friends, and he's one of my best friends now. But also, he really inspired me in just my own musical things and always moving forward and always just kind of, you know, he was always positive and he was always like, hey, you know, you can do this and you can do that. And it was just really amazing when I thought about how much influence his music has had on my own, you know, career as far as just wanting to write and mix. And he's a phenomenal mixer. The other person who's really influenced me a lot around the podcast was Rob, actually. I got my job with Stevie Wonder, you know, as a drum tech, and I thought I was pretty hot stuff, right? Because I was keyboard tech for Teddy Riley, and I was doing all these big MIDI things, and then I got the Stevie Wonder, and I knew nothing. I met Rob, and I felt like so unworthy, and
I'm glad I could help.
No, I'm serious, Rob. You really lit a fire in me as to just. I mean, I thought I was at a high level in my knowledge, but it's nothing compared to when I got the gig with Stevie and saw all those keyboards, and you're like, oh yeah, blah 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 blah. You know, you walk up to the Synapse and blah blah blah. Okay, done.
That's like watching him type. Goes.
No, it was just really, you really have influenced me back then, just to really dig into it and just to really just to wrap myself into it. Cause I figured if I could know it just half as good as Rob knows this stuff, then I'd be someplace, you know, you know, employable.
Well, and I was getting the same kind of pressure from Stevie to learn this stuff. I mean, that's one thing about the whole Stevie organization, and there's no shortage of people who've worked with him or for him at some point in their career. And everybody will tell you that it's kind of like the University of Stevie, you know.
Right.
There's just something about the energy around him and what goes on with him. And because I was introducing him to computers at the time, I was spending, you know, 25 hours a day with him, it seemed like.
Right.
But, you know, when someone is that excited about what they're doing, it becomes infectious. And so that rubbed off on all the people around him and still does.
Well, it was like, man, all I remember is, you know, having to learn not only – you know, you have to have your MIDI chops up because we had a, you know, we were running multiple, you know, 18 out Synapses, fully packed. And then, but you also had to have your computer skills because they were running Cubase. And then I had to learn a little bit of this crazy WaveFrame thing because he was working with that. I mean, it was just some serious stuff. And, oh yeah, by the way, you got to make sure you can run this in like Singapore.
Right.
You know?
So, in the dark.
Yeah, it was
pretty... And there were cues, like Stevie would be counting off a song and you'd have to know what the latency of all the hardware was. So if he was counting off Part-Time Lover, you'd have to start like 3/16th notes before the downbeat.
Ooh.
Or you'd be off. And he'd count it off. He'd go, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'll never forget, anytime I hear anyone count, because I had it so burned into my brain, it's 1, 2, 3, 4. That's where you had to hit play. And if you got it wrong, then a gigantic stadium or arena or park or whatever would just hear a train wreck. So there was really good incentive not to get it wrong. And, you know, now there are so many tools that we didn't have back then, but it was as much a musical gig as it was a technical gig. And that was true for all the techs.
Oh.
You know, the guitar techs were expected to know all the alternate tunings and what songs required what, and there was nothing simple about it for anybody.
No, it was the major leagues as far as teching go. If you survived that, then A, it meant that you didn't get fired, and B, that, you know, you had some chops. But I just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to take the time, Rob. Thank you for being such a positive influence, and I wanted to open up to you guys. If you
did we pay you, by the way?
No, but
okay, cool.
But you know, I tell you, you know, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about right now or if you want
to. I don't mind, because I know that was one of the incentives that got you thinking about this.
Yeah, it absolutely was.
I'll just, in a nutshell, I'll let everybody know what was going on. Right after we, when we recorded the last podcast, I don't know what number this is or what number
this
that was.
105.
This is 105?
Yes.
If not?
No, it is 105.
We'll fix it in the mix. Okay, when we recorded podcast 104 a couple weeks ago, right. And it was on a Tuesday, and my dad had been sick, not for that long, but for a few months, and things had started to get worse, and the family was telling me I needed to race back there to see him. So we recorded the podcast on a Tuesday. First thing that Wednesday morning, I think I left the house at 4 a.m., I raced back to Philadelphia, and I managed to get there in time to see him, but then he passed away on Saturday. So I got... whatever it was, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, to be with him. And we knew, I knew he was near the end when I called or got the call. And it was all kind of sudden. He was only 72 years old. And he was definitely my biggest influence growing up when it came to music. And, you know, my whole career with Stevie, he was kind of living vicariously through that. And Stevie ended up getting very close to my parents, too. And it was all a really good relationship. But... I knew growing up that my father was into music because I knew how excited he got whenever we were talking about musical stuff. And at his memorial service, a lot of different people from different parts of his life spoke, including the sax player from his band when he was a teenager.
Huh.
And my father was he was a singer and an upright bass player in the Catskills and in the North Jersey Shore. And this is when he was like, you know, 17, 18, 19. But he had that look. He was the real tall front man. And he totally loved music. He decided not to go into music as a career. He was deciding between history teacher and lawyer, and he became a lawyer. And as I said at his memorial, gave me totally the wrong idea about lawyers because he was such a nice, you know, happy, loving person. But all through my musical career... we always have had this connection. Like the first night I met Stevie Wonder, it was at his house in Alpine, New Jersey. We had sort of crashed a party that I was in a band at the time, and our manager told us we were invited to this party, which everyone seemed to believe except security at the party and anyone else around Stevie. So we kind of drove, whatever it was, 2 hours to crash this party. I finally met Stevie. It was a listening party for In Square Circles. It was summer of 1985. And the first thing I did after I met Stevie was run into Stevie's kitchen and call my parents and wake my father up and tell him, I met Stevie finally, you know, because Stevie had been my idol since I was a little kid. And my father really liked Stevie's music.
Right.
So we had that connection. And every step along the way through my career, we had that kind of connection. And at one point, a long time ago, we were doing a TV show. I was already working for Stevie at that point. We did a TV show honoring Sammy Davis Jr. It was his 60th year in show business, I think. And backstage, you know, it was a normal TV kind of gig. But backstage, Stevie introduced me to Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
And all I wanted to do is shake his hand and then run into Stevie's trailer and call my father, which is what I did. You know, and we just always had this connection. And every step along the way... my parents, and my father in particular, gave me license to just do whatever I wanted to creatively. I'm the oldest of six, and all the rest are doctors and lawyers and nurses and veterinarians and marketing specialists. Did I get everybody? Yeah. And, you know, all very professional. And I was always the crazy one who got to come to California and be in the music business. But as a result, Stevie's whole organization got to know my parents really well. I felt terrible when I had to break the news to everybody in Stevie's organization that my father was so sick, and the outpouring was unbelievable. And Stevie actually recorded a message for me to play at the memorial and was very broken up about it. He was very close to my parents from the day he met them, which is 25 years ago. Hmm. You know, the whole band had been to the house. We had barbecues on the beach with them. I mean, really a family kind of relationship. And if I have to think back, this one moment keeps coming back to me as I think about my father all the time and everything we went through creatively. Is I think it has to be, it's definitely my proudest moment. And I think it was my parents' proudest moment for my career was, it had to be 1986 or 1987. And we were playing Radio City Music Hall. That was before you were there, right?
Yeah, it was before.
And Stevie wasn't there for sound check. Once they discovered that I could play, you know, keyboards and mimic him a lot, I could handle his sound checks and he wouldn't have to be there, at least in the beginning of the sound check. And we were at Radio City Music Hall. My whole family was in Philadelphia. And I called them and they all drove up. And they got to sit in the front row of an empty Radio City Music Hall while I played front and center on stage with Stevie's band behind me. And I just remember sitting at the keyboards and looking down at my parents. And if it was possible to explode in pride, they were exploding. And I just thought, this is the coolest moment ever. Because I had dropped out of college to meet Stevie. I really had no plan other than I wanted to meet him and do something with him.
Right.
I knew he didn't need another keyboard player because he had all the best ones on earth and he was a great one. And so my angle with him originally was in computers and technology and that kind of stuff. But once he realized I was a musician, he gave me license to do these kinds of things. And I'll never forget that moment at Radio City. That was pretty cool.
Wow. Well, that's pretty awesome.
That was pretty amazing. So, you know, we've had, it's not like we didn't get to have hundreds, if not thousands, of amazing creative experiences together.
Right.
But there's nothing I do creatively where I'm not picturing my father, you know, reacting to it.
Wow.
And I would, I put up a memorial page at arbiteer.com because I wanted to sort of, I wanted people to be able to send the family messages. But in the beginning, we were so overwhelmed with phone calls and emails and everything, it became almost more than we could handle. It turned out that thousands and thousands of people loved my father. He was a very popular guy. He was involved in a lot of charitable things and neighborhood things. And he was voted one of the top 10 lawyers in Philadelphia year after year. And he didn't fit the stereotype of a lawyer. He was just an incredibly happy, humble, warm, loving person. And that's what everybody kept saying over and over again. So I set up arbiteer.com so people could send messages to the family in a way that wouldn't be so overwhelming. And I don't know if I'll have it up by the next time, by the time this podcast is posted, but I'm actually putting together on the website now where you'll be able to read more about him, and I have movies and pictures and video and things to just kind of paint a picture of who he was, because he was a pretty incredible guy.
That's so awesome, man. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, you're a pretty incredible guy yourself, and you know, we are our parents' legacy, you know, and
well, I think he's covered in the legacy department. I don't think any one of the six of us live up to him, but I think the combination he was pretty proud of.
Wow. You know, and when Rob sent that email, I'll tell you, it just really broke my heart, but what was really kind of cool, and I will say this, is just to see the response of the different guys in the podcast. And it's just like, you know, we kind of have our own little family here. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's pretty fantastic. I mean, if you're out there listening to, you know, to the podcast, you know, I hope you surround yourself with other guys that, you know, maybe you don't podcast, but maybe you're in a band, or maybe you have people you like to work with or something. But there's nothing like having just that support, that structure. Just, I don't know, just, it's just, there's some comfort.
I can tell you from firsthand experience, nothing else matters. All that matters is your friends and family. And all this career stuff is fun, and, you know, trying to make money is fun, and getting out there and kicking some butt is fun, and all the competition is fun, and music is fun, and everything else is fun. When those moments happen, and if you're lucky, they don't happen to you too many times in your life, but when those moments happen, all that matters is your family and friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's it.
That's so true.
I think it's it's who you share the moments with.
Mm-hmm.
Because that defines it. And that's why, you know, working with crews. I mean, if you work by yourself all the time, it's not as fulfilling. But when you climb mountains together.
Right.
You know, whatever challenges of life. And when you do that with other people, that's what creates the memories.
And there's no substitute for it.
No.
You can't fake that kind of life experience. You've right. either been there with a person or not. I mean, that's one of the reasons the Stevie crew is such a family, because we've been through like undescribable stuff. And some of it's undescribable because of non-disclosure agreements. But some of it's just so, you know, strange and crazy.
Some of it's just so wacky.
Yeah.
I mean, we will never lack for stories. I will tell you that. Never.
And you know what? Those moments, like standing on the beach in Brunei, wondering how we're going to get wayframe parts for a show in 8 hours as all the equipment is exploding because it's 100% humidity and we're 10 billion miles from anything.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment, I wasn't a big fan of that experience. And now looking back, it's one of my fondest memories because it was just so ridiculous.
How about racing across the desert in Dubai? Because the promoter didn't bring a bus to pick us up. And so we all had to jump into cabs and go like 60 miles to the airport across the desert in the United Arab Emirates. And nice. You're just hoping, you know, that throughout this caravan of 7 or 8 different cabs, that everybody makes it there.
I remember so many instances which... You know, everybody was saying, this will make a great story if we don't die. There were so many of those.
Scott, tell us somebody who was just a really great influence in your career.
I started thinking like how long I can go with crickets. You know, I think early on for sound design, probably the two was Ben Burtt and Walter Murch. Star Wars and Apocalypse Now. And I wasn't sure. I mean, I wanted to be somewhere between a rock star and an astrophysicist. So, and somewhere in between. And
how did that work out?
Yeah. I'm an audio techno geek. I don't know. So, you know, I saw that, and because they had different approaches to it, Ben Burtt created amazing sounds that defined sound and cinema in a signature way. What I loved about Walter Murch was not the sounds themselves, but using interesting sounds in unique ways to tell stories. And as a musician, I was more into storytelling. I loved orchestral music. I loved film score music. In some ways, even more the pop music. I liked something that had a beginning and end and a story that when I closed my eyes and listened to it, it took me somewhere.
Right.
And... So, you know, I get so many influences by so many things, a lot of them in the music business. A lot of, I love Pink Floyd. I find it incredibly inspiring. As we've talked over the 105 podcasts, a lot of those musicians and bands that have really interesting tonal sounds that just take me and let my imagination zoom and soar. I mean, there's so many people. I don't think there's any one person in my life, but like we talked about friends and, you know, it's all the people when I was in Up With People and all the people that I've worked with and all the people I've went to war with in all the projects we've done.
Right.
And I guess the other person that probably I owe a lot to in my career is Wiley Stateman, who is one of the founders of Sound Deluxe because... You know, I was kind of a wild child, and I kind of needed to do it my way, and I just wanted to run with it. And he let me do that. He gave me opportunities when nobody else would.
Right.
And he let me fly as high and as fast and as far as I dared. And we've been partners and friends for almost 3 decades.
Wow. Bobby, how about you?
I've had a lot of them, but there's two that, one early and one late, and we'll leave the ones in the middle alone for a second. The first guy was someone that no one will ever know, Jim Strachaker, who was a singer in a band I played with. He was a lot older than I was, and he taught me the value of dynamics. And up until then, you know, just being in a band that was, you know, bash it out as loud as you can, which most young bands do. And he was the guy that really beat it into me that this is important and it's something that really makes a big difference. So he was a big influence. And then later in my life, more recently actually, is Tom Holman. And Tom Holman, because when we were all getting into surround sound for music, I was having trouble. I remember I was doing a... there's 4 or 5 of us giving a presentation before... the Grammy committee before NARIS, and I was having trouble calibrating a system and for music, and everybody was saying, no, there's a way to do it. You don't understand. And I was saying, no, you don't understand my problem. Tom was the only guy that got it and came up to me afterwards and said, wait, let me see if I can get this. And he was the only guy that actually said, okay, let's figure this out together. And then I learned a whole lot from him afterwards.
Wow.
And again, he's, you know, one of the, he's the godfather of surround sound.
Right. Really smart guy.
And he's taught me a whole lot.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Brandon, how about you?
Well, first influence, I guess I'd have to say was my, although maybe not the man, but my uncle loaned me his drum kit when I was 10. And so I had my first Ludwig late 50s, early 60s maple drum kit to play, which was awesome.
Wow.
So he was a big influence, although he didn't live nearby, but that enabled me to get into music and start playing, and that was awesome. And then throughout my experience in life, I guess it's been mostly, you know, bandmates that were better than me, you know, and just made me step up my game. And then as far as career goes, I have to say you guys. I mean, Mike brought me into this, and I'm, you know, couldn't be more grateful for sitting in a room with such awesome talent all the time and just hearing you guys speak and hearing your stories and learning about gear, and just it's forced me to up my game quite a bit and become better at what I do. So thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Well, you're pretty darn welcome, and you're pretty darn good too. Well, hey, you know, I just want to go ahead.
You gonna tell us about you, Mike?
Yeah. What's yours?
Oh, I already did with Martin and Rob.
What you doing these days, Mike?
But you know what? I will say that I think there's two people that musically really influenced me early on to go the way that the career choice that I had, and one of them was my parents, actually. So I guess it'd be three people. But like my parents, much like sounds like Rob's parents, you know, they let me do whatever it is that I wanted to do. They were not, they always smiled, and it's like, hey, I want to do this and I'm going to do that. And there was something really kind of cool about every little step of success, sharing it with your parents, like calling up my dad and calling up my mom and saying, hey, and I did this, and hey, I did that. And the first time that, I remember that they got to see my name in a credit on a TV show, they were ecstatic. And it's those little things that for me, it's kind of like my way of paying them back. Like, you know what? Thanks for not forcing me to be an accountant, and thanks for not forcing me down this road. And thank you for expanding my horizon, and thank you for, you know, having an open mind. And it's so nice to be able to pay back with little nuggets of success every now and then. And just to see that the glow or hear the pride. And I know what you're talking about, the pride in your father's voice, or watching them smile, you know, totally non-music related. But junior high, I was a phenom in basketball. Then I stopped growing. but we were playing this one night game, and I'll never forget, for some reason, I just had the hot hand. And the second half, I scored 17 baskets. Or I mean, 17 points, not 17 baskets. But all I remember is every time I made a basket, I looked over at my father, and he was just laughing and just smiling. And that was awesome. So I guess, you know, if you're a parent out there, now that I'm a parent, and you know, I love just to see, you know, all my kids, and I just want to encourage them to do anything. I mean, my daughter went to New York for the first time. She's all a big buzz about being an actress and stage, and she can sing, and she just won this Shakespeare Festival in Southern California. She won the whole thing, and so it's like, I was really proud of her. And so I just want to, you know, encourage that. And I encourage people out there, if you have kids, and if you, you know, you can really do a lot of influence when they're young, and you can really help set them up for success, because it's half the battle.
You know, and you know, I've got a son as well, and we were talking about influences, and you know, your father influencing you, Rob. And what I'm also finding now that I'm on the other side now, I'm the father. My son actually influences me right now probably more than anyone, because one of the interesting things is, and he's a young child at the moment, he is exploring life for the first time and seeing it through new eyes. And I think what happens is, as professionals in our industry, we get so wrapped up in the politics and the day-to-days and the successes and the failures and the wants and all that stuff that we accumulate that sometimes we forget about the innocence of it. And you know, when they ask you really simple questions that you go, huh.
Yeah.
And it makes you stop and think. And I think that while the child is many times influenced by the parent,
right,
I actually think the parents are also incredibly influenced by the child.
Absolutely.
No question. And I will say, you know, I'm very lucky that I got a zillion opportunities to, you know, tell my father something cool or have him see me do something cool or, right, you know, whatever. But, and I'm going to put up, I have some great pictures of him hanging out with Stevie and the band and everything.
That's,
you know,
cool.
We had a really good time. But, you know, he's been gone for a couple weeks now, and there have already been plenty of times where something happened in the day and I was thinking, oh, I got to call Dad and tell him that. You know, I don't know if that ever goes away. My guess is it dwindles over time, but, you know, it's just a tough time.
Wow.
So, you know, make sure you have as many of those happy, good moments as possible when you can. That's one thing I have no regrets about. We had no unfinished business and no, like, unfinished topics or anything. I knew exactly how he felt about me, and he knew the same. And I'm glad we had as many great opportunities to hang out and everything as we did. But you never know when it's going to end, so don't take it for granted.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? You can't. Can't say any much more than that. I mean, that's it.
I could. How much time we got? No, I'm done. I'm done.
No, we're wrapping this. Well, hey, listen. The last thing is, you know, all you guys are awesome. You're all just phenomenal in all your different disciplines. But I will say too, we got to totally give it a shout out to the listeners too of the podcast, because I get the emails from you guys and see the comments that you write, and we've got some really good loyal listeners. That some of them have become friends that I can truly say are friends. You know, and there's just some great people out there. There's just, you know, there's some really good people. And I want to thank the listeners. Anybody who's listening to this podcast right now, you know, you're awesome, because quite frankly, sometimes it gets busy and, you know, I'm juggling a zillion things at the same time, but I like doing the podcast. I just get a buzz at hanging out with my friends, and you know, I can't play poker, so this wouldn't make a good poker game. But it's fun just to get together and just to have, you know, just to have a purpose and to see our little family growing more and more, and the listenership going up and going up and going up. It's pretty cool. So, you know, thank you guys out there. And
all six of them.
We now have eight.
All right. Eight.
Who won the book?
The podcast actually just posted.
Oh, nobody won. Oh, okay.
Nobody won it yet.
Oh, okay. Who's going to win it?
But I will say, hey, what Bobby's talking about is we are giving away a autographed copy of one of Bobby Osinski's books called The Ultimate Guitar Tone Handbook, and it will be signed by all the guys in
the
podcast.
Which is awesome.
So,
yeah, we have to give it away before Scott steals it. That's pretty obvious.
at the beginning, I'm like, wow, look at this. Wow, this is great.
So all you got to do is just send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we're literally just going to pick a random email, print them out, pick a number, do dice, whatever. We're going to figure out a way, but you can't win it if you don't send an email in. So, and even if you're going to send an email in to ask a question, we'll put you into the running. So all the guys are going to sign it, and it's just a way of us saying thank you, and we're going to try to actually give away more stuff, because we did it. We gave away something, and it actually made it there.
That's
so
pretty awesome. Did you get confirmation that it arrived?
Yes, we got pictures. That was the API packages. So
nice.
That was really kind of cool. But, you know, before we go, I do want to encourage you guys out there, you know, find a little family, man. Find a little group of musicians. Find a little group of engineers. Just, you know, you guys, you can't do it alone, you know.
Find people with the same passion.
Yeah. Exactly, because that's going to draw you out. And you know what? I guarantee you, you're going to get work out of it too, because that's usually how it goes.
And family has a lot more definitions than you probably think it does.
That's true. All right. Well, about the only thing that's left to say is, I love you guys. I love all of you. And on that note,
Should we talk about what we're working on?
Yeah, you working on anything fun?
Actually, in the middle of all that crap I've been going through, we're actually working on a really, 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 really cool project for a video game I'm not allowed to talk about. But I will be able to talk about it later in the summer, and it's music-related and really cool.
Cool.
A lot of cool stuff going on for me. we've got Sherlock 2 happening.
Nice.
We've got Rise of the Apes, which is exciting. And then another one I can't mention, which is a big superhero movie.
That's my favorite. Yes. Just because you can't mention it.
It's also my favorite.
It's either bip or bip or bip, you know.
And Scott's working on... Okay, moving on.
Yeah. No, you know, it's I've had a nice run over about 2 or 3 month period. Finished Green Lantern. That should be coming out pretty soon. Finished something that I can't talk about, which is really cool. And I'm mixing right now. I guess I could say... video game, that's all. I can't say the title as of yet. But it's been fun because, you know, and, you know, we were talking about all the things. And I've actually learned a lot on this podcast because, like, I've started, I've just got a whole bunch of UAD stuff that I've been trying out for these mixes. And it's been great because I've had just enough time on these projects to experiment. And I'm just a kid in a candy store. So it's been fun. And so that's kind of what I'm doing.
Nice. Bobby?
I'm working on, well, same thing as last time. Working on a couple of books. One is the Memoirs of Ken Scott, which is very cool. It's a lot of fun. I'm going to do two different 3D music shows and just waiting for scheduling on that. And I'm in pre-production for a record that I'm producing, and that's about it.
Nice.
And you, Mr. Mike?
Let's see. Well, last time I talked about a commercial that I mixed, and it wasn't released yet, and it's where I did most of the sound effects with my mouth. And it has been released, so I can talk about that. That was Newegg. They, when you see newegg.com, they're running some TV spots, but it's also on YouTube. If you listen to the soundtrack, it's a guy whistling. So I figured, well, if the guy's whistling on the soundtrack, you know, I might as well do a little So there's one synthetic swoosh, but all the rest are pretty much me just in the booth doing swooshes and then manipulating nice. Them. And they're real subtle. There's nothing big, but it's all like, you know, stuff like that and the pops and stuff. It was kind of fun. And we're doing more of those. And so you'll see some of those signature sounds now as, you know, out there. And then the other thing that I just finished, and it should be up by the time this podcast post, is I mixed the another Prey 2 trailer. I just did the stereo mix. It was one of the situations where they wanted me to mix it, and so I got the session, and there was like 170 tracks, and here's 3 hours. it's 170 tracks. but fortunately, the guy, Gary, oh, I forgot his last name, who did the sound, it was the sound design, did a fantastic job. So it was definitely... he made it really easy to mix fast because he pre-mixed a ton of stuff. So kind of whipped that into shape. And he did such a great job. I was just honest with him. And I said, hey, they wanted a 5-1 for E3. And as much as I would have liked to have done it, I didn't have the time. And so Gary did it. And from what I understand, he did a fantastic job. So I'm looking forward to hearing that at E3. Between that and basically just trying not to die by working a gazillion hours. And actually what Rob was saying, you know, I had to take the weekend off because I just had to be around my family. I just had to be around people that, you know, that I love and that love me and that won't make me, you know, change levels of things. So step away, you know, sometimes you get too close. But hey, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. If you want to win the copy of the book, The Ultimate Guitar Tone Handbook, you can send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And then you can also post comments or questions on our Facebook page at facebook.com/audionowcast. Other than that, I think that's about it. I think we covered everything.
I think so.
So from myself and all the guys, take care and give somebody a hug. I'm not going to give you guys a hug. But,
okay, audio group hug.
I love you guys. Okay, let's hug. All right. We'll catch you next time.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.